songs sum up very well what that encounter with Jesus and the woman at the well are actually all about. That search that people have within themselves to find meaning, to find something that satisfies them. The Rolling Stones, they were... Trying to do two things at the same time. This is very difficult for my little brain. Here we go. The Rolling Stones, when they were singing about trying to find satisfaction in life, or, and let's be generous to Mick Jagger, he was trying to find satisfaction in relationships. He probably isn't quite there, but he was trying to find satisfaction in something. Bruce Springsteen was singing about everyone having a hungry heart, that everyone's got a sense that they want to find something which satisfies them. Westlife, complete with emotional key changes at all the right moments. They sing about that everyone's looking for that certain something, something that makes it all complete. And then there was U2, with a gospel choir, including lyrics which seemed to say that whatever they had done, they had climbed mountains, they'd scaled walls, they'd maybe even had religious experiences, but for them they're saying in that song, still haven't found what I'm looking for. And today, the encounter with Jesus and the woman at the well is meant to show us this. Only he can satisfy us. Only he can bring deep meaning to our souls. He can quench the deepest thirst we have within us, much more than achievement can, much more than popularity can, much more than relationships or sex or money or power. Jesus is the one who can truly, truly satisfy us. This encounter also teaches us other things. It teaches us literally that no one is ever too far gone in terms of their history or their current behavior to have everything turned around. Absolutely anyone can be changed. So what we're going to do is we're going to look in on this encounter. We're going to listen to the conversation between Jesus and the Samaritan woman, and we're going to see how he is the only one who can really, really satisfy us. And if the PowerPoint starts to not match up with what I'm saying, I hope you can forgive me. So we begin with a very human picture of Jesus. He is traveling back to Galilee. He's traveling back to Galilee, and his route is taking him through Samaritan country. It's hot. It's noon. He's going this way because he wants to avoid the Pharisees. He's starting to get a bit more popular than John the Baptist, and he just wants to avoid a confrontation at this stage. It's hot. It's noon. Jesus is tired. And the disciples leave Jesus sitting by a well. They go into the nearby town, and they're going to buy food. Jesus is there, and he's alone. And then something happens. In the distance, through all the heat, haze, and all of that sort of stuff that goes on, he starts to see a woman in the distance. She's carrying a water jar. And she is a woman who, despite any bravado, despite anything else that's going on in her life, she's deeply, deeply dissatisfied. Her life has not gone as she wanted it to do. And the first thing we see in this encounter, probably one of the really big things, is this. It's what you can see up on the screen there. No one is beyond Jesus' help. Because if Jesus was ever going to choose to ignore anyone, it's this woman. If he was going to ever ignore anyone, he'd have ignored this person. Because at the end of verse 9, if you've got your Bibles open, there's a little phrase there which only begins to hint at how likely it could have been for him to ignore her. Because it will say something like, Jews do not associate with Samaritans, or it might say Jews do not use the cups that Samaritans have used. Jews and Samaritans, they didn't like each other, yet Jesus wants to transform this Samaritan. And the animosity between these peoples was centuries old. In fact, they're actually distantly related. They're people groups which are distantly related. And if you know some of the history, it starts to help you see why they just dislike each other so much. So, hundreds of years before Jesus meets this woman, there's an event in their history where their nation splits into two. They split. And the split only ever seemed to widen. So a bit later on, Israel was conquered by various peoples, and some of the people were taken away. They were taken off to Babylon, and they were taken there. The rest of them who stuck around, they did some things like this. They married with the other nations around them. They kept their kind of Jewish religion, but they mixed it together with the religion of the people that they intermarried with. And essentially they formed a new people group. They mixed together, they merged the religion, and so eventually when the proper ethnic Jews returned home, they looked at these descendants of the people who'd split from them and married with other people, and they looked at them through the eyes of racism. They looked at them and said, these people are not ethnically pure anymore. They looked at them and said, they're religious compromisers because they've taken our lovely pure religion and they've mixed it with other people's religion. They thought of them as not worshipping God properly, as traitors to God, so they wouldn't even use a cup that a Samaritan had touched. That was the animosity between Jews and Samaritans. But layered on top of that was a whole bunch of cultural stuff as well. So Jewish men of the day, they wouldn't speak to any unknown woman in public for fear of what it might do to their reputation. Because they thought, if we're seen talking with any kind of woman, hey, people are going to look at us and start to gossip. Some rabbis, some Jewish teachers, even took it as far to say that publicly a man should not even speak to his own wife. Now, whilst I think that's taking it miles too far, there are some shopping trips where that would have served me well. If I just said nothing, I'd have avoided a whole bundle of trouble. So, in terms of a conversation striking up between this man and this woman by this well, it's got two strikes against it already. She's from the wrong nation, she's a woman. Why would he talk to her? And then there's something more on top of that as well. She's coming at noon. She's not coming to this well at the time when you go to draw water. She's only going at the time to go to a well when you want to avoid people. She doesn't want to be encountering anyone. The only reason she'd do that is if she's an outcast, even among a group of outcasts. She's so disliked, she's so ostracized by the people that she lives among, she'll endure the heat of the day rather than endure the heat of rejection. And so as she approaches this well and she sees a Jewish rabbi sitting there, she expects an awkward silence at best. That's what she expects. She expects a disgusting glance in her direction. She doesn't expect what happens. So with all of that baggage, with all of that stuff which should make Jesus not talk to her, what do we see in verse 7? Jesus says to her, "Will you give me a drink? Will you give me a drink?" And when Jesus just speaks those few words to her, I think he reaches across every single barrier that people can erect between other people. So he speaks across race, he speaks across culture, he speaks across gender, he speaks across moral conventions and says, actually, I'm going to reach out to this woman, I'm going to try and build her up. That's what he's doing. He wants to connect with her and he wants to transform her. That's really quite radical. That's an incredible thing for anyone to do. And it does beg a question of those of us who are Christians. Would you do that? Would you do that? It should get us to look at ourselves and say to ourselves, who is it that in my world and in my culture and in my upbringing and in my religion, who are the people that I wouldn't associate with? And it says to us, you should offer them a drink. So right now, if you can think of anyone, an individual or a group of people that you wouldn't want to associate with, you need to see Jesus reaching out, reaching across everything, and seeking to change a life. That's really quite a challenging thing for us to hear. Jesus wouldn't let anything get in the way. And at the same time, if you're someone, and actually being in church is one of the most difficult places for you, because secretly you identify with that woman, you need to hear that whatever barriers you think there might be between you and God, God will reach across them to you. He'll stretch out his hand to you. And if you had been the woman walking towards the well, he would have offered you a drink as well. So to all of us in the room, Jesus would have offered us a drink as well. And if that shocks you, it shocked the woman as well. She did not expect Jesus to speak to her. And so what does she say? She says, "You're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan woman, how can you ask me for a drink?" And essentially what she's saying there is, what are you doing? She might even be being a little bit sarcastic with Jesus. And what happens next should maybe shock us even more than the fact that Jesus speaks to her. because Jesus is warm and he's friendly to her. He is going to confront her about her life. He is going to do that. But before he does that, he ignores every barrier. What does he do next? Jesus offers hope. So to a woman who probably knew she was sinful, Jesus offers hope. And again, I think that's an example for Christians. He doesn't begin this conversation with the woman by the well by going for the jugular and saying, you're an immoral woman, you've had however many husbands it is, you're living with someone who's not your husband. He doesn't do that. He doesn't tell her, sort yourself out straight away. He tells a woman who probably thought there was no hope that there is hope. That's what he does for her. He tells her that there's hope. She probably didn't think that any Jew would ever offer her hope. What she needed to hear at that moment was not that she was a sinner. She probably knew that. She needed to hear there's hope for sinners. And Jesus does it in a really strange way. If you follow the conversation through, it's a bit of a strange one, because he says to her, if you knew the gift of God, so if you knew what God could offer you, if you knew who it was that's speaking to, he's saying, if you knew who I am, you would have asked me, this tired rabbi sitting by a well without a bucket, and he would have given you water. Water that would fill you in such a way that you never need to drink again, because it's going to bring eternal life to you. It's going to satisfy you more than anything else can. Now, what's Jesus talking about there? Because if you take it literally and just literally, Jesus is a man suffering from sunstroke and he's delusional. It's a metaphor. The water that he's talking about isn't actual water. It's a metaphor. And this is something that maybe we don't get quite as keenly as ancient people, or as keenly as people who live next to deserts. The thing about England is this. We describe it as a green and pleasant land. Actually, more often than not, it's a cloudy and wet land. That's what it's like. And we don't perhaps get thirst the way that they got thirst. Now, one of the great things about speaking in church, it happens everywhere. Everywhere you go, you get a glass of water. It's so good. It's lovely. It's refreshing. You should all have one. It's fantastic. It's really good. And the thing about a glass of water is this. You know it's refreshing. You know that when it's hot and the glass is cold enough, you get the condensation on the outside. It's just so refreshing on a hot day. And if I was to spill that glass, which I'm probably quite likely to do if I don't watch what my feet are doing, then I know that no matter how thirsty I am, I could either go back there and steal the musician's water. I could do that. I could go over there and get a jug of water, another jug there. I could go find your kitchen and I could get myself a glass of water really, really quickly. Wherever I go in life, I kind of think that I'm less than a minute away from fresh water if I want it. That's the world that we live in. Put yourself into her shoes. She lives in a dry, arid climate. She lives next to a desert. There is no Evian. There's no running water. There's no fridge. Every day, she's going to need water. She's going to have to travel in the hot sun each and every day with a massive, great big pot to collect water and bring it back. She's got to do that simply to sustain her life. That's what she's got to do. A spilt glass of water for her would be a tragedy. For us, it would be a mess that the visiting speaker should have cleared up. For her, it would have been an absolute tragedy. To be thirsty where she lived at the time she lived is to be close to death. Because if you're in a hot climate and you're made mostly of water, and water's difficult to get, if you're thirsty, you are close to death. To be dying of thirst, they say it's to be in agony. So what's Jesus saying to this woman is this. He's saying, I can give you something which will be more satisfying to you spiritually than water is on a hot day. He's saying he can give something which satisfies that much. He's saying, if you come to me and you just ask, if you open up your hungry heart, if you say, I haven't found what I'm looking for, and you come to me, your thirst can be met and it can be quenched and it can be dealt with. Jesus is saying he can provide deep satisfaction to the longings of her soul. And there's a verse that we can so easily skip over. Verse 14. The metaphorical water that Jesus wants to give her becomes a spring that wells up to eternal life. That's bringing hope to a hopeless person. For someone who's just being looked down on every single day, that brings real hope. So for a moment, let's put in those songs that we started this message with, which spoke about this. They pretty much reflect how we all search for something to satisfy us. We look for something. And in this verse, actually, I've missed a point I wanted to say. It talks about it becomes a fountain of water within you. Within you. Not outside of you, within you. How we tend to look for satisfaction is we look for something outside of us. Something outside of us which is going to make us feel special and perfect and satisfied. So we look for things like relationships. That if we've got that special someone, then we are satisfied. It might be possessions. If we've got the right car, if we've got a house, if we've got the career, if our family are happy, if we're popular with other people, if we're thought of as being funny by those around us. That was always my one in school. If people thought I was funny, that satisfied me. If someone else funnier came along, I was all over the place. I did not like that person. We look for something outside of us, generally, to satisfy us. So right now, ask yourself this question. What is it that makes you happy? What is it you look to satisfy you above everything else? Naturally, most of us will look at something outside. We'll look at it and we'll think, if I get that, I'm happy. If I get that, I'm complete. If I get that, I'm significant. If I get that, I'm secure. But none of those things, not forever, they won't keep us satisfied. Because let's say you are looking for that special someone. I don't know who's single and who's not in the room. Say someone's looking for that special someone that they think is going to make everything right. And you can see them. You've got your object of affection and you're trying to get them. You're playing every card that you know to attract them. You're doing everything you can. You're dressing as you think will attract them. You're fluttering your eyelashes. You're doing whatever it takes. And they don't notice you. Or worse than that, they reject you. If you've set your heart on that person, that's going to be deeply dissatisfying. As I said, if it's thought of as being funny and someone funnier comes along, that will mess your world up. If it's your career that is the thing for you and trying to get the next job up the ladder is what you think is going to satisfy you, and someone else with shinier teeth and a better suit and a nicer car comes and takes that job, that is going to make you dissatisfied when you go back to your office. If it's your children that satisfies you, and you're happy if they're happy, if anything threatens their happiness, you will be all over the place, probably more so than they are. If you look to anything outside of you to give you satisfaction, ultimately, it's in danger. And Jesus is saying this. He can provide a deep satisfaction for your soul, even if everything outside you is a mess. So if there's a storm raging in your life, if your children have gone off track, if your career's not where you wanted it to be, if your exam results in just a few weeks' time, I don't know if anyone's doing exams, but if they don't go as you hope that they're going to go, then whilst the storm might be difficult, inside you'll be safe and you'll be satisfied and you'll be okay. It'll be like there's a storm raging all around you, but you're in the eye because you're satisfied. And Jesus is saying he can do that. He can satisfy us. We have a problem with this, though, because most of the time we're insulated from recognizing that what's outside us can satisfy us because, let's go past that. Because this is us. This is us. That, most of the time, is the thing that we really, really want, the carrot. And we are the donkey and we're trying to get the carrot. And we pursue it, and as long as you haven't actually got it, you can think that that thing's going to satisfy you. So you can call this dissatisfaction ambition. If I just get that carrot, everything's going to be okay. We can call it drive and think, I've got to go after it, I've got to get it. We can be oblivious to the fact that if you do get it, it won't satisfy you. It won't satisfy you. It'll just be a carrot. It'll just be a carrot. And when you hear people who've dreamt for something and they've got their carrot speaking, sometimes you get to see this. So there's a quote which Alexander the Great, apparently he got his carrot. Now this isn't actually a true quote, but it sums up very nicely. He conquered most of the world, and it's said that he said when he looked at his kingdom, he wept because there was nothing more to conquer. That for him, conquering stuff was what satisfied him. And when there was nothing more to conquer, he was dissatisfied. People can have everything they ever dreamed of and find it's not satisfying. So Will Smith, the actor, he will say this: I'm never going to be smart enough. I'm never going to be a good enough father. I'm never going to be a good enough husband. I'm never going to be a good enough actor for myself. He's got everything, but he can look at himself and say, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough. Boris Becker, quite topical with the Wimbledon final today. He can say this: I won Wimbledon twice. I was rich. I had all the material possessions I needed. Yet it's the story of movie stars and pop stars who commit suicide. I had everything, but I had no inner peace. When the donkey gets the carrot, sometimes it can be that the carrot wasn't everything he dreamed of. It still doesn't satisfy him the way he wanted it to. It's a great carroty, crunchy moment, but once it's gone, it's gone. Everyone has to live for something. And Jesus is saying, if you live for anything that isn't him, the Bible will say this, if you live for anything that isn't Jesus, it will fail you. It will enslave you. If you fail it, it can never forgive you. So if you fail your career, if you don't get to where you want to get to, and that's the thing you live for, it can never forgive you, ever. It would only let you down. So, let's go back to the woman at the well. Verse 15. She's been listening to what Jesus has said, and she says, She gets there, and it's as if she's got it. She understands that Jesus is offering her something that can really, really satisfy her. So she says, go on then, quench my thirst. Give me this water so that I'll be satisfied, so I don't have to keep coming back to this well. Now, if Stuart was here, in fishing terms, he would probably say something like this. This is a woman who's on the hook. She's taken the bait. She's right on the end of the line. And all Jesus, it seems, he has to do, he's got to reel her in. He's got to reel her in and drop her in the keep net, and he's got her. Jesus does something weird. Have you never read this and thought Jesus does something weird? He does something that utterly jars. So there she is saying, give me this water, give me this water. I want to be satisfied. She's saying that. What does Jesus say? He says, go call your husband and come back here. Why does he change the subject? Why does Jesus suddenly seem to change the subject? She was right there. She wanted the thing which was going to satisfy her. And it looks like Jesus changes the subject on us. This is the awkward conversation she wants to avoid. Why has Jesus gone here? This is the key thing to this passage. Jesus has not changed the subject. He hasn't changed it at all. He's getting her to realize something. For her, her desire for men and her desire for marriage and her desire for being with someone is the thing she was looking to satisfy herself. It was what she wanted to satisfy her hungry heart, and it hasn't worked. She needs to see it clearly, and she needs to see that it needs to stop. So her sin, because she is a sinful woman, is not so much that she's lived an immoral life, which she has. The sin under the sin is this. She's refused to go to Jesus to have him satisfy her. She needs to let Jesus take the place that men had taken in her life. That's what she needs to do. Now, from that moment on, Jesus then reveals to her everything that he knows about her. They have a discussion about locations of worship. And then she says, I know that when the Messiah comes, he will explain everything to us. And Jesus says, I, the one speaking to you, am he. She leaves her jar. She goes back to the people who probably ostracized her, who looked down their noses at her. She goes back to them and says, come and see this man who told me everything I ever did. And she's changed forever. Suddenly, men are not so important to her. Jesus is. And she shows this because she tells people about him. She's changed. Now, what would Jesus have said to you? If you'd been by that well, he asked her about husbands. What would he have asked you about? What would he say which would make you uncomfortable? What would be the conversation that you'd want to avoid? That reveals what you desire most. And this is a question Christians need to answer as well, because other things can take Jesus' place. In the book of Jeremiah, in chapter 2 and verse 13, it talks about living water again. It says this: my people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me. So God's not in the place that he should have been. The spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. Now, if this morning you find following Jesus a chore, if church, and I shudder to say this, is boring sometimes, if you believe in God but actually living as a Christian is just drudgery for you, you need to maybe ask yourself, what is the thing I'm looking to satisfy me that is not Jesus? You've got to find it, you've got to discover it, you've got to tease it out. What is the question Jesus would ask you? If you were sitting by that well, what would he have said? Would he have said husband's career? You've got to tease that out if you're really struggling as a Christian. And then you have to place it against who Jesus is. Because there's another strange bit in this story. The disciples come back, and all they seem to want to do is to get Jesus to eat. So they keep asking him, have you had some food? Would you like some food, Jesus? Here, Jesus, have some food. And he doesn't seem to want to take it from them. And then he does the same thing with them that he was doing with the woman. He says to them, oh, that's the end. He says to them, my food is to do the will of God and to finish his work. What brings deep satisfaction to Jesus, what sustains him, is this food. And it's to complete the work that God has given him to do. And when we look at how Jesus completes his work, that's how we can get satisfied in him. How does Jesus complete his work? Well, let's look at the woman to start with. This woman has her entire life transformed because Jesus was thirsty and tired and he looked helpless. When he was sitting by that well, he was all of those things. He was thirsty, he was tired, he looked helpless. And it's the same for us. When we see Jesus in a place where he's thirsty and he's tired and he's looking helpless, that's where he can actually satisfy us. Because there's another occasion when Jesus is all three of those things. At the cross, Jesus hangs there and he says, I'm thirsty. And on that occasion, he's not going to get anything to drink, nothing that really satisfies him. He's physically thirsty and he's spiritually thirsty because he can't find God when he's on the cross. He can't find God's presence. He's helpless. He's hanging on a cross. He's nailed there. He's helpless. And he's tired, the most extreme form of tiredness, because he's dying when he's up there. And he's dying for you. He's dying to cover every sin. He's dying to cover every time you put something above him. And he's saying, I'll pay for that. I'll cover every single sin and I'll transform these people to be everything that they can be and to bring them into my presence and to give them eternal life. That's what Jesus is doing on the cross. And he does that because it satisfies him. He does it because he wants to please God. We sing of God's amazing love at times. At the cross is where you see his amazing love. It really is. As he dies, he completes God's work. And what does he say on the cross? He says, it's finished. I've done it. In that moment, if you trust Jesus, every time you've messed up, every time you've not given God the place he deserves, everything you've ever done wrong is gone. It's gone forever. It's covered. It's forgotten. It's completely atoned for. And actually, God then sees you as perfectly as he sees his son. And you don't deserve any of it. That's water that satisfies your soul. That's something which is going to be better than a career, better than a relationship, better than money, better than sex, better than power. And the question you have to ask yourself is this: have you found what you're looking for? Have you found it? Jesus is saying to you this morning, he satisfies more than anything else. He says, reach out to those you might look down on. He says, offer hope. He says, he can be the thing which answers the question, the cry of your heart, which says, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. We're going to close there, but I'm going to give you a moment of quiet to respond. And if this morning you're thinking to yourself, actually, I need to come back to Jesus again, do it. If you can identify the thing which gets between you and God, admit it to him now and say, I want to put you first, Jesus. If maybe you look at your life and you say, all of my life I've been putting other things before God. All of my life I've been putting other things before Jesus. See if he can satisfy. Maybe say to God, you say you can satisfy me, Jesus. I give you a chance to do it. And maybe give yourself to him for the first time. And he will satisfy your soul. It won't always be easy, but he will satisfy you. He asks you to come, and he asks you to drink the water that he gives. So let's have a moment of quiet, and then I'll pray.